Is he my prince? Is he the toad? Waiting, wondering, is getting too old. I'm gonna let down my hair, slide up my skirt. Welcome to the Shame Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
Thanks for tuning into the Shame Free Zone. This is Veronica Monet, and we're getting a little bit of a late start here. I apologize for that. We had a couple of technical snafus, but I've got a really great show for you tonight. We're going to be talking about shame and sex addiction and maybe some other things. I don't know. My friend Eric in Seattle is joining us. He's got a bunch of questions for me, and I never know what he might put me on the spot with, so I'm actually kind of excited to see how he's going to interview me. Eric, welcome to the Shame Free Zone.
Thank you, Veronica. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, glad to have you here. We always have such a good time.
Well, I always learn something, and that's definitely worthwhile.
Thank you. I'm glad. I learn a lot, too, by the way.
Well, good.
Yeah. So, I know you got a list of things.
I do have a list of things. I've been thinking for weeks.
Awesome. I'm thrilled. Lay it on me, baby.
All right, here it comes. I was mostly focused on what happens when sexual trauma surfaces in a relationship.
Yeah.
Some past stuff. So, I don't know if you want the personal story, but I ask from experience, what do you do when your lover suddenly starts having trauma flashbacks in your arms?
Wow. You know, it's a tough situation because a lot of times we're in a vulnerable place where our egos can be easily bruised and we might feel like that we've done something wrong. And I think what happens a lot of times for couples is the person who gets triggered might say things like, why did you do that, or I don't like it when you do that, and somehow it gets personalized. And I really strongly recommend that we don't use words like you, because if we can own it and say, this isn't working for me, or I'm getting triggered, it takes a lot of the sense of responsibility off of your partner. But, you know, unfortunately, sometimes when we get triggered, we don't have the presence of mind not to say triggering things. And so then what ends up happening is both people are triggered. Now, one person's triggered because they're having flashbacks. The other person's triggered because they feel attacked or blamed in some way. If you know that you are with a partner who has a history of sexual abuse of one form or another, and you're able to talk about that with them and find out what their triggers are, that's really helpful. Then you can kind of map out a plan, like how we're going to avoid certain triggers. I know in my case, I was molested by my father by him coming up from behind me. So my husband, I asked him, please don't come up from behind me. And if you do come up from behind, don't touch me. And if you want to touch me, ask for permission and give me a few beats to breathe, check in with myself, and see if I'm okay with being touched. Because that was just a highly charged situation for me. And obviously, you know, the first few times we didn't know I had a trigger. So this is the problem. You know, you don't know that you got a trigger until you stumble across them. And then once you see that, you know, that this situation is really loaded for you, then you can start having a plan for how you're going to avoid the triggers. That's one way. But let's say you're at that stage where you just don't even know what the triggers are, and your partner doesn't know where their triggers are, so you're both kind of navigating in the dark here, you know, struggling to try to figure out what the what the terrain looks like. That is pretty scary for all concerned, and your plan has to be different. It has to be, instead of how to specifically avoid or deal with certain triggers, it becomes, what do we do when the unexpected comes up, when we're both blindsided? Because the person who gets triggered is just as thrown as the other person. They're usually confused, frustrated, angry, sad, oftentimes disappointed in themselves. Why am I doing this again? Why is it taking so long for me to get well? This is stupid. I can't understand why this particular thing is bothering me. So there's a lot of self-recrimination. And then the other partner will feel like, oh, I should have known better. I shouldn't have done that. Or they may feel defiant, like, how the hell am I supposed to know? And if we can avoid those kind of things, and oftentimes it's just good to ask your partner, do you want to stop touching? Would you like to touch in a different way? Because once they're triggered, they might feel abandoned if they say, you know, this isn't working for me, and then all of a sudden you were to pull away. It could possibly give them a sense of being abandoned. On the other hand, they may absolutely need for you to stop touching them and to give them some space. Anything less than that might feel claustrophobic. They might feel cornered, trapped. So it's difficult. It's tender. It's for all parties. But you have to ask some questions like, would you like me to stop touching you, or would you like me to just hold you here? What feels best? And then you really have to wait. You can't pressure them for an answer, because a person who's triggered is very confused. And there, you might encourage them to breathe. You might encourage them to get centered. You might say soothing things like, you're safe, I'm here for you, and just tell me what you need and want in this moment, and I will be there for you. Those kind of things can be very reassuring. And then it gives that person a chance to figure out what they want, because likely they won't know. You really have to think about, like, if you are dealing with a small child and how you would help that small child figure out what of many different choices they would be best for them in that moment. Because, you know, if you give a child six different choices and they're three, it's going to be very confusing. If they're five, it's going to be a little less confusing. Maybe by the time they're 12, they'd actually have a ready-made answer. A lot of people are sexually abused at very early ages, so when they get triggered, you are, in fact, dealing with a small child.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, Eric? In my situation, it was like I ended up with a five-year-old in my arms, and that was just a little strange.
Well, it can kind of make you feel really, you know, scared yourself, or like, why? What am I doing in bed with? You're right in the middle of a sexual act. You think you're with a fully conscious adult who's able to give their consent, and all of a sudden you're with a child.
Yeah.
How did you handle the situations when they came up?
Well, no judgments. I didn't know what to do, and I actually asked her, you know, hun, are you okay?
Yeah.
And she responded, oh, no, I'm fine, keep going. Which, you know, in retrospect, I probably shouldn't have listened to. But, you know, in any case, I did. And we finished up, and by that time, she was completely gone. I mean, you know, there was just nobody home. And so I just cuddled her for a while and finally said, you know, again, hun, are you okay?
Yeah.
And this little five-year-old voice came back, are we done yet? And all I could answer was, yes, dear, we're done. It was lovely. Thank you. And then over about the next 10 minutes, you know, she kind of came back. And the grown woman came back, but with no memory of what happened.
Wow.
And, I mean, what do you do then? When she has no memory, I mean, do you start digging? Do you...
I'm not sure
what is good for them.
It's not, sometimes it's not important to try to process it in the moment. Sometimes the most important thing is to just try to, you know, if you're with a five-year-old child, what do they need and they want? If you see that your partner has really regressed into being a five-year-old child, it would be best to get out of a sexual situation.
Right, yeah.
In retrospect, and certainly, like you could, you know, if they're naked, you could actually get a blanket, wrap them in the blanket, and speak to them in very soothing tones, offer to get them a hot chocolate, read them a story. I mean, I'm serious about this. It's like being very nurturing, in a way that doesn't have a sexual overlay to it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I mean, I've gotten so regressed in therapy that I forgot how to drive a car. So it's pretty serious stuff. It can take you way back.
Yeah.
And you're very vulnerable. And you know, as far as forgetting it, that's very disturbing because now you've just had an experience. You want to process it, and your partner can't process it with you.
Yes, exactly.
They don't even have an awareness of it. Now, did she at some point get an awareness? Did she ever remember?
Not that she ever said to me.
Yeah.
I don't think so. I think there were still lots of walls and stuff.
Hmm.
So, and that brings up the whole issue of consent. You know, do I start questioning and trying to pull up that stuff? Do I honor those walls as boundaries? You don't want to remember, then, you know, more power to you, lady. You remember, you don't remember just as hard as you need to.
It's
difficult to...
Well, it is difficult. It's very scary when your partner is in denial about something. And especially, you know, I know for me sometimes I can feel a little lonely. It's like I have this awareness, but I'm in it alone.
Yes. Exactly. Oh,
yeah.
My. Yes.
Yeah. It's like I can't talk about it with this only other person who was in the room with me when it happened.
Yeah. Who else is there?
Yeah. Yeah. And it depends on the partner. If my partner is working all their stuff and here's just this pocket that they're not aware of, well, then a lot of times I take kind of a philosophical attitude towards it, and I think, well, you know, I have my own. I have areas that I'm not aware of, and, you know, in this way we can complement each other and help each other, and it kind of lends a meaning to my connection, because then I see, well, I'm here to kind of carry this and hold space for it, if you will.
Yes.
I can hold space for this person eventually being able to remember these things and heal. If my partner's not making any effort to get well, they're refusing therapy and mm-hmm. they're medicating themselves with medication or alcohol or drugs or something like that, well, then I have to seriously question even being in the relationship, because this person's probably not going to get well. And, you know, I have lots of compassion for the person who is a survivor, but as their partner, I want to have compassion for myself, too. And, you know, the compassion that I want for me is that I deserve to have a partner who's available and fully present. And every time my partner goes into denial or gets regressed, on some level, I'm getting abandoned. And that's not really fair to me.
Well, I guess that's true, isn't it?
Yeah. But, it's, you know, you have to look at the whole relationship to be able to determine if this is one that really merits being in it.
God knows,
you know,
we all have baggage.
Huh?
God knows every relationship has baggage.
Well, yes, absolutely. So it's kind of like being at an airport terminal. You get to choose what baggage you want.
Yes.
And some people just have baggage I don't want to carry.
Too true.
Yeah.
Oh. So what does it mean for me when my lover has these flashbacks?
Well, what does it feel like to you?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, my two alternatives is that, you know, I've done something to trigger her. I've been in some way abusive, and then that's triggered those memories.
Yeah.
Or the alternative is that I've created enough safety for her that she's able to actually start feeling what's really going on inside, and, you know, lo and behold, here's all this stuff.
Right.
Or some combination. I mean, you know, life's all about mixtures. At the time, I felt like this was clearly something of hers, and she didn't want to know about it, and so I was going to keep low profile. And, I mean, just for historical, you know, truth, the relationship pretty much ended in a couple of months, so I'm not sure that was the right way to go, or whether there was any way to go that would have worked at that point anyways. But I'd like to not make the same mistakes again.
Well, so what I'm hearing, I'm not sure what mistake it is you don't want to make again. Are you not wanting to pick somebody who's that damaged, or are you not wanting to handle the situation with a damaged person the way that you did it?
I want to be able to step in and know exactly what to do and make everything better. That's what I want, Veronica.
Right.
Come on. Okay, first of all, you can't do that for the other person. You can't
no,
make
you
them
can't.
Better.
Yeah. So, you know, there's things. Let's say you're in a relationship with somebody that you want to stay in, but you don't want to be so adversely impacted by their trauma.
Okay, some things have just got to get fixed. Okay.
Yeah, so you... There's ways in which you can kind of ameliorate the impact on you, and also, you know, that a lot of times has to do with boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
So for instance, you know, instead of worrying about how you're going to take care of the survivor if they get triggered, if they don't want to participate, if they're not showing up to have an awareness about this, you might need to shift your focus to how you're going to take care of you. And then maybe you'd want to forewarn them and just say, it's very difficult for me when you get triggered. I'd like to work with you on it, but you don't have a recollection of it. I just want to give you a heads up that the next time it happens, I'm going to have to do this and this to take care of me. Now, it might mean leaving the room, stopping sex altogether, because, you know, it's too scary for me, it's too traumatic for me, it's too disorienting for me. Whatever's true for you, right?
Mm-hmm.
But were any of those things true for you? Were you ever scared or disoriented?
Scared or disoriented? More just I had to dissociate, too.
Yeah.
And, you know, at that point, you know, what's the point?
Right. Well, just the very statement, I had to disassociate, sounds like a false statement to me.
Oh, yeah?
Well, yeah, because nobody is forcing you to disassociate. That might have been what you did, like you got triggered and then you did disassociate.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes,
But nobody can force you to disassociate from, because, I mean, disassociation is really, that's a lot more than detaching. Detaching is making a conscious decision to move away from a particular stimuli, but disassociating is, that's going on automatic pilot, you know, it's like now something else is controlling you. So how did that come out for you? I mean, like when you say I had to disassociate, what do you mean by that? Maybe it's just terminology difference here. You might actually be meaning that you, had to put up a boundary or something. I don't know. So maybe if you tell me a little bit more about what you actually did, then I'll have a better idea of how that could be tweaked so it'd be more helpful to you.
I guess I'm not really sure at this point.
Okay.
It felt like I needed distance.
Yeah.
I needed some kind of barrier. I needed to say,
okay,
this isn't, I'm having a hard time saying it. I needed to say, this isn't my lover, this is just sex.
My lover's what?
I needed to have enough distance that I could just say to myself, this is just sex. This isn't another person here across with me. This is just, we're just having sex here.
Oh.
So that's what I mean.
Yeah, that sounds like a defensive measure, like you're creating kind of a, instead of asserting a boundary or disassociating, actually, it sounds more like kind of a defensive measure, and sometimes that's the best we can do in the moment, but it's not usually the best course of action, because on some level we're calling upon ourselves to kind of shut down our heart and be,
yes, well,
be less joyful, less vulnerable, less alive.
Okay, I completely get that. I mean, if you want to have a relationship, you got to be there for it.
Well, yeah, it's kind of. And I mean, not that I have anything against just sex, but if you're just going to have sex, it'd be nice for it to not be coming from a place of self-protectiveness, you know? I think that's a sad combination. I mean, it, even if you're just having sex, it'd be nice if it's a safe environment.
Mm-hmm.
So, do you get the sense that your partner getting triggered was actually creating less safety for you?
Well, totally. I mean, I was worried. What did I do? And what's going to come back at me? Yeah, very much.
Well,
so.
When she'd get triggered, would she act out? Would she do things that were hurtful or painful for you?
Do we really want to go here? Yeah,
don't have
not
to.
The 5-year-old wouldn't do that, but other versions would.
Mm.
I guess that's the only way I can put it.
Yeah. So somehow or another, it would become your fault then.
Yeah, I mean the 5-year-old I can only weep for, but
the what?
The rest was rather the 5-year-old I can only weep for.
Yeah.
I mean, but the rest was rather. A little dangerous.
Well, you know, there's nobody as dangerous as somebody who sees themselves as a victim. Some of the most powerful perpetrators are self-described victims. It's, you know, when you go to death row, a lot of the people there are convinced that they got a bad rap, somebody took advantage of them. The reason they had to do what they did is because somebody forced them to it. They had no choice. They're a perpetual victim.
So I think I didn't hear you right. You said nobody is as dangerous as someone who is a victim?
Yeah, somebody who is a self-described victim, yeah.
Self-described victim, got it.
Yeah, people who think of themselves as victims feel justified for any perpetration.
Right, they're just protecting themselves.
I had to kill them.
Yeah.
I had to hit her. I had to cut off his penis. I mean, these are people who think they're victims, so they do incredibly noxious deeds, and then they justify it as the only way that they could survive or prevail or keep any kind of sense of dignity, you know. If I have a friend who has started thinking of themselves as a victim, I want to get as far away from them as possible, because I know that they are much, much closer to perpetrating, they will feel justified.
Wow.
Like they're, you know, they're, the world, the life is not being fair, so they're going to have to make it fair at any cost.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a little scary.
Well, it's just, it's good to know that, you know, whenever you're dealing with somebody, no matter how sad their story is, the only way that they're really safe to be in a relationship with is if they have been able to find their responsibility. Now, this is really tricky terrain, and I have worked with rape survivors, and I would never, ever want to inculcate in a rape survivor the belief that they were somehow responsible for their rape.
Okay.
And yet, there are certain things that we can teach women in particular to protect themselves from rape. And one of them being, you know, to stand erect, look straight ahead, look alert, because people mm-hmm. who look down at the ground and shuffle their feet are just statistically more likely to get raped and mugged. So you got a statistic like that, but the last thing you want to do with it is, cause somebody who's been raped or mugged to feel like it was their fault.
Right. Absolutely.
And it certainly isn't their fault. Nobody ever asked to be sexually abused or raped, and no matter what you did, what you wore, what time of day it was, you're innocent. The person who rapes or assaults is the one who is culpable for their actions. And there are no excuses. And that's hugely important, especially for women, because women over the years have been called upon to take responsibility for all of their victimization. It's like, you asked for it because you're a woman. It's terrible. But the other side of that, you know, everything in life is about balance. So if you know this, if you know that the world has had a history of blaming women for their own abuse, and in fact, the world has done that. The world cultures have been doing that for 6,000 years. It's horrible. It's just like in the fabric of society at this point, and it's really hard to fight. But as individuals, we can't get too caught up with the historical reference because that can disempower us and put us in a position of feeling, you know, sorry for ourselves. And at some point, if we take responsibility and better our lives, we can have a more positive impact for ourselves and for the people in our lives and for society at large.
Let me ask you a question. Are you saying that when you've been victimized, you need to take responsibility for your recovery or something, or what?
Definitely take responsibility for your recovery and move from the place of feeling like the world is a dangerous place and you got taken advantage of into the place of feeling empowered, that you have got the ability to create positive change in your life. And if you're living in that space and really, you know, believing in yourself and looking to resources and healing modalities, then you become a safer person. I'll give you, you know, we're talking in vague generalities here, so let me get specific because my own life is often my best example here. When I was just coming to grips with the fact that I was a rape survivor and an incest survivor, I was a very, very angry, volatile person. And I had every right to be, and I was actively digging up all these old memories, and thank God I was, because the only way I can extirpate those is if I actually bring them to the surface, give them air and sunshine, and allow them to fade off into nothingness. And that's a very painful, long, drawn-out process. But while I'm in that stage, I'm not a particularly safe person to be around. I'm too volatile, too angry, and I have no sense of how I'm moving in the world. I don't have a sense that there's anything I can do in the future to protect myself, to change my life so that I don't have to keep getting victimized. So I'm seeing myself as a victim of life, and therefore justified in whatever abuse I mete out to the world.
Ah, because it's just payback or something.
Yeah, I like to call it the Thelma and Louise syndrome. Women in particular, especially women of a certain age who, you know, grew up with that film, will feel like, hey, you know, I can't do anything wrong because I'm the victim. It reminds me of a boyfriend I had who told me he couldn't be racist because he was black, and yet he'd go on and on about Asian people. So really, so you can't be racist. Well, good for you. So, you know, seeing how you have been victimized can create a lot of license to be abusive.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really important piece that a lot of times our culture doesn't reflect back, because we do feel so sorry for the victim, and we just kind of stay in that place.
Right.
So in other words, what I'm suggesting is if you have a partner who has been victimized and is still suffering the signs of the abuse, you know, they're not safe unless they're taking responsibility for their own recovery and taking concrete steps to try to get well. If they haven't done those things, then they're not particularly safe to be around. And then additionally, you can spend a certain amount of your time and energy being nurturing and responsive to their needs and trying to help them, but it has to be balanced with self-protection and building boundaries where you protect yourself from their propensity to be abusive. People who have been abused, it's very rare that they actually understand what it means to not be abusive. They've been living in another world where you get abused or you abuse. It's like, and you know, when they stop, you know, they say, no longer am I going to be abused. I'm not going to let people take advantage of me anymore. Oftentimes, then the reflex is to go into the abusive behavior because that's the only alternative model that they're aware of.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So does this sound familiar? Kind of like,
You
know, the person that you're talking about sounds like they're kind of oscillating back and forth between being a 5-year-old who's heavily triggered and then being a punishing partner.
Maybe so. I certainly had my 50% in it.
Sure.
So the signs, you said, the signs that someone's been abused, what are these?
Signs of abuse. Well, of course, it depends on what type of abuse we're talking about. If you're talking about sexual abuse, there's a certain amount of breath holding that can take place if certain body parts are touched, and not in a good way. But,
uh-huh. But
you know, it'd be like some flinching, tensing of muscles,
okay. Right.
Holding a breath.
The
other thing is that sometimes there is an inability to track the interaction, like they keep leaving their body or thinking about other things, getting distracted, having trouble staying with the activity at hand. What are some of the signs that you noticed?
I don't want to get too personal, but yeah, a lot of distraction. Maybe I should just leave it at that.
Huh?
I'm sorry. Maybe I should just leave it at that.
Okay. So they were distracted at times.
I mean, because these are all real people. I don't really want to be carrying
their
laundry on. Yeah, distraction, flinching, not being there. Just the kind of rigidity that you can't reach me.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can't reach me. I'm out of your reach. That kind of an attitude.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Rigidity is definitely a self-protective measure. We can do this, but we can't do that. I'll do that position, but I can't do that position. I can do it in this room, but I can't do it in that room. You can touch me here, but you can't touch me there. If you have a lot of rules and there's no spontaneity to the sex, and it's not got the rhythm of a dance, a shared dance, but it becomes kind of like, okay, do this to me, but don't do that. That could be a sign. It's not necessarily. They could also just have obsessive compulsive disorder or be a hugely codependent, controlling person. But it also can sometimes be a sign of sexual abuse because it's a coping mechanism.
Actually, a lot of this is sounding real familiar in me. I mean,
familiar in you? Do you have reason to believe you might be a survivor of sexual abuse?
I don't know, but she said there were a lot of landmines.
Hmm. Yeah.
Huh. Interesting.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The federal government just changed their definition of rape. Just this last week, as a matter of fact, to include men. Men can now be rape survivors.
Hey, we're moving up in the world.
No kidding. I'm kidding.
Or something.
Well, you know, it could be very, very good news. I think right now the statistic is only 1 in 72 men is raped. But that's still more than we thought. 1 in 72 is actually quite a bit. And, of course, some of that includes people that are underage.
Oh. Because that's just, you had me reading The Survivor's Guide to Sex by Stacey Haynes.
In
her intro, she claims 1 out of 3 girls and 1 out of 6 boys.
For sexual molestation, yes.
Molestation. Oh, that's
now,
not rape.
The statistics are sorted out differently. So
molestation
and rape are not counted as the same crime, which I have a huge problem with.
Well,
because sometimes
I'm not
the way
clear on
the laws read and the way the prosecutions ensue, people who are guilty of molestation have actually inculcated more damage. They've created more damage, but they have lighter sentences than the person who is actually charged with rape. And I think that gradually that is starting to change, but, there's a lot of disparity from state to state. Most survivors of molestation absolutely feel that they've been raped.
So
let me give you a for instance. Even now, with this change, it's a dramatic change in the rape laws so that men are included in it. But it's still defined as penetration of the vagina, penetration of the anus, or penetration of the mouth. So, in some molestation...
So, only a guy can...
Huh?
Excuse me. Only a guy can do this then, right?
No. No. You could use a toy or a foreign object. But I know what you're saying.
Thank you.
It's unfortunate that we're still stuck on this model that penetration is the litmus test for rape. Now, it's a good thing that they are including foreign objects. It doesn't have. It can be a finger. It doesn't have to be a penis. So if a finger is inserted or a foreign object is inserted or a penis is inserted in some part of the human body, then that can, and there's no consent, it can be considered rape. And the other thing that changed about the law is that they used to want it to be that you were physically forced.
Right.
Now, you don't have to have tried to fight off your attacker in order for it to be considered rape. All you have to have done is either not given your consent or weren't able to give it. Like maybe your mentally compromised, inebriated, you know, drunk,
unconscious,
loaded, something like that. Yeah. However, now let's see why it's different with molestation. Molestation can be getting your breasts fondled. It can be an older adult taking the hand of a child and putting it on their erect penis. You see the ways in which no penetration ever takes place?
Right.
Yeah. And then the law will not consider that rape. They'll consider it molestation. I think, you know, if this person is a, you know, a child under the age of 13 and you're over the age of, 17, then we need to be considering this. I would consider it rape, but then, you know, we always get into the whole age of consent thing. Like,
right.
Most of us remember having sex with somebody who was an adult while we were underage. And we know it wasn't rape, you know? But,
well, the abuse of the childhood trust is
what?
Maybe even worse. The abuse of childhood trust is maybe even worse.
Yeah, I think it is. I personally think that childhood sexual abuse has a lot to do with the amount of violence that's in our culture.
So, chasing that one, there seems to be a lot of difficulty in even facing this kind of thing in our culture. And so I wonder, do we need, like, more people outing themselves about this? You know, I was raped, and here's how I survived, and here's how I'm recovering.
I think so. I really do. And if you know what, speaking of the 1 in 6,
uh-huh.
Well, 1 in 6 is the statistic you quoted from Stacey Haynes' book, The Survivor's Guide to Sex. 1 in 6 males is molested as a child.
Right.
There's actually a website called 1 in 6.
Is there?
Yes, 1 in 6. I think it's 1in6.org. 1 in 6 is specifically for men to come out about having been sexually abused as children. I think those stories are hugely important. We need to be able to have conversations about it, because for the same thing that what you saw in your partner who could not remember her triggers, didn't know she got triggered, and was not available to process it and take responsibility for it and talk about it, and then she became more dangerous to you. She wasn't available for the connection. And the compassion and the relationship. And so there becomes an angry edge to people like that. So when we're not talking about these abuses, a lot of times we're creating a society of very angry people.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's powerful stuff. And it comes out one way or another, it seems.
Oh, it does. It does.
So what about a movie? My daughter made me watch this, A Beautiful Mind, that details some guy's fight with schizophrenia. Is the world ready for a movie about someone's struggle to recover from sexual trauma?
Well, I sure hope so, because it's funny. On Facebook tonight, I just got a message about the movie Shame. And the movie Shame is about a guy who's a sex addict. And it seems that in our culture right now, we're really overusing and misappropriating this term sex addiction. And that's where our focus is. And I would love for us to be talking about, you know, the very real problem of how people have been sexually abused. I don't think that the world is ready to do a movie about men who are sexually abused, but I think they might soon. I mean, certainly after what happened, you know, with that Duke University and all the young men that were molested by the coach, and his name is escaping me right now. But I think
I kind of avoided that whole thing.
Did you?
Yeah.
I think that it was Duke University. I'll look it up here in a minute. But that's brought it to the fore here, you know, where we're talking about it now.
A point.
About the, you know, molestation. And
I think that we're supposed to be safe, yeah.
And if I got the wrong university here, I'm going to find out in a minute. I'm going to probably be apologizing
yeah,
on the air here. Oops. But, you know, this whole thing about this is that you can find some kind of a scandal for just about anything out there.
We are all people.
Huh?
We are all people, that's for sure.
Oh, my God. Okay, so it was the wrong university, but they have had a scandal in recent history. 2009, gay Duke University official molested black adopted son.
That gets all that's all the triggers, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. there's way more of this going on than you know, than we want to think.
Than we want to admit, yes.
Well, you know, it's so much easier to point the finger out there somewhere.
Hmm.
And it was Penn State.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. And Penn State had a whole, but Coach Jerry Sandusky, actually, who molested kids as young as 10 years old.
But he hasn't been tried yet, has he?
Well, not yet, but he thinks that he is innocent, as he's been on television talking about taking showers with these boys and kind of wrestling around in the shower with them naked. But that's okay.
Well, yeah, I wasn't there. I'm glad I wasn't.
Oh, it's pretty horrible, actually, what happened. Somebody actually saw him in the act of sodomizing a little boy. And they just walked away.
Yeah.
They walked away because they were embarrassed. They didn't want to believe what they saw. And then, of course, nobody wanted to rock the boat.
Yeah.
So you ask, is it a good thing for us to talk about these things? I think it's imperative. You know, the more we talk about this stuff, then when the next little 10-year-old boy who gets sodomized might find his courage to go tell.
Right.
Which would mean that then only one little boy would get sodomized, not, you know, how many ever Sandusky's been accused of molesting.
Another question?
Yes.
Real quick. So next time when my love and I find ourselves in this place, and where do we start? What do we do? Are there resources you go to?
Well, there are. Now, you've got Stacey Haynes' book, Survivor's Guide to Sex.
Uh-huh.
She's also got a DVD, which is like a companion to that book now. And you can find it online. And it's called Healing Sex. And she's got physical exercises that you can do in the DVD. And they're designed for partners to do together. And it's also got some great role-playing. They've got some actors who have role-played a lot of different possible scenarios and given you, you know, ideas on how, okay, somebody, your partner gets triggered right in the middle of sex. What do you do? How do you cope with that? And one of the things you can do is just stop. Stop sex and go do something else. Another thing that you can do is make a choice to continue to have sex, but maybe in a different way that doesn't activate that particular trigger. And it really has to be up to the sexual abuse survivor to decide if they want to try to move through the trigger or if they want to avoid the trigger or if they want to stop altogether because, you know, sex is just too painful at that particular moment.
Right. But in any case, you have to bring them back enough that you can ask them and get an answer.
Yeah, well, it's really something you need to have a plan for. So your partner needs to be able to acknowledge that they do get triggered. If your partner can't even acknowledge that, you're in a bad situation.
Yeah, I guess.
And at that point, if you decide just to want to be in the relationship, you know, it's going to be incumbent upon you to put up your boundaries and say, when this thing happens, and you speak in neutral terms, you know, you don't want to psychoanalyze your partner. You can just say, when you do this thing, then I'm going to have to do this thing because I don't want to be around for that. And I don't want you to feel abandoned, so if at some point you decide you want to investigate that particular thing, I am here to help you investigate it and move forward and find a different way for you and I to connect. But for right now, I just need to protect myself and remove myself if this happens.
Wow.
And that's actually, that's great because you're protecting yourself, but you're also protecting them because if they are triggered, then this is going to be hurtful for them. And they may not know it. Mostly survivors don't know that they're triggered and that they're doing something that is hurtful to themselves. So have a plan. It's like scuba diving, Eric. Plan your dive and dive the plan.
Sex,
when you're dealing with incest and rape trauma, sex can be the same way. You have a plan with your partner. You know, try to avoid the triggers if possible. Work through the triggers if you're ready for it. And just stop having sex altogether if the triggers become overwhelming.
Wow.
And then what do? Oftentimes, you don't want to, like, just go into your separate corners. That can feel very punishing.
No.
Yeah. It'd be better to stay connected somehow. Even if
you go have a bowl of ice cream.
Yeah, you could do that. You can read to each other. You can cuddle, you know. In some way, try to keep the connection.
Right.
By the way, if you do decide you want to go into the trigger, I recommend something called sensate focus. This is a technique developed by Masters and Johnson's back in the 70s. And sensate focus stops advanced forms of sexual interaction. It takes us back to the basics around kissing, eye gazing, touching, holding, and then eventually working its way into foreplay. And so it really gives everybody a chance to slow down, figure out how they feel. And it can feel very confrontive because all of your, you know, apprehensions about intimacy can come up.
So you're backing away from sex and working for the connection.
Certain things that people consider sex, I actually consider sex to be the connection, but things like genital touch, you would not touch each other's genitals. You would look into each other's eyes and breathe together and hold each other and perhaps touch each other's neck and back and arms and legs erotically, but staying away from the breast, staying away from the nipples, staying away from the genitals until a month later. So maybe once a week for 20 minutes you do this exercise of just touching the parts of the body that we don't usually associate with sex, unfortunately, because we have such a limited view of sex in this culture.
Mm-hmm.
And gradually you work your way into touching nipples and breasts and genitals. But you would still not do penetration, because penetration is more confrontive and creates a lot more vulnerability.
So it's almost like remapping the whole process.
It is. In a lot of ways, what it does is it really does allow you to build new synaptic connections. Your brain gets to rewire itself, and you get to have new responses.
Huh. That sounds intriguing.
It's actually a beautiful process. I've done quite a bit of it myself, and I love it. And I recommend it for my clients, and I've seen it work miracles for them.
Huh. So you help people with all this kind of stuff, right?
Yes, you know that. But thanks for reminding our listeners.
Well, it's 10 o'clock right now, right?
Yes, we probably should. We got a late start here, but yeah. Was there one last question, Eric, before we go?
The tag on my about books and other resources, are any written from a man's viewpoint, a man having been abused?
Alas, none that I know of. I know a therapist in California who's been doing quite a bit of research, and he had a video out. I have not been able to find out how I could obtain a copy of that video. I don't even think it's out for public consumption at this point. So I'm not aware of that.
Do you think it makes much difference? I mean, is a woman's trauma?
You know, I think we do need.
So
you know, we do need men to start sharing their stories. I'm just doing a quick search here to see if anything comes up in the way of a book. But if somebody knows about a book out there, I certainly would like to know. There's becoming, you know, more and more websites. I'm seeing, like, we've got malesurvivor.org, National Organization of Male Sexual Victimization. And I know that RAIN also has speakers that are male. I was just reading a New York Times article yesterday, actually, about a male survivor of rape who has become a spokesperson for RAIN. RAIN is spelled R-A-I-N-N. Rape, abuse, and incest. But I'm not aware of books at this point. And, you know, I got a feeling one's just around the corner. I think we're fine. This topic is actually starting to get some momentum. If you find one, Eric, let me know.
I sure certainly will.
Okay.
All right.
Check out the DVD by Stacey Haynes.
Okay.
Yeah. I think it's specifically for couples. You know, the book is more geared for individuals. I think the DVD is more for couples.
So she does some of this sensei touch. Is that what you called it?
No, a little bit about sensei focus. But no, she's actually got some somatic exercise. She does somatic therapy. So she has exercises for people to do, kind of standing up, fully clothed type of exercises.
Mm-hmm.
But they're very much in the body. No, sensei focus actually was developed by Masters and Johnson's back in the 70s, and that's something I prescribe for my clients, and I've seen it has really created a lot of value for them.
Well, I want a do-over.
Yeah.
I want to have a do-over.
All right, well, I better sign off here. Just to my listeners, next week I want you to join me. I'm going to be interviewing Beverly Gopp. And our topic is going to be the vagina gratitudes. Thanks, Eric.
All right, thank you.
All right, good night. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with you. Sering kesepian.